Hello and welcome along to Northumberland FA podcast series from the sidelines with myself, Gary Middleton, and special guest today, head of basketball at Newcastle Eagles, Ian McLeod. Ian, pleasure to have you on from the sidelines today.
Yeah, thanks for having us, Gary. Looking forward to it.
Great stuff, Ian. Ian, just before we get started, can you just let everyone know on from the sidelines listening in today, your present role at Newcastle Eagles, as well as your previous coaching roles?
I think as far as the previous coaching roles go, it's basically every role you could have done. So this is my 22nd year with the Eagles and the Eagles Community Foundation. I've done everything from a bag of basketballs on the back, traveling to do a session for an hour, to after school clubs, to curriculum coaching. The academy, which is our sort of elite next level youngsters, worked right the way through with yourself at Gateshead College as part of that, of course. 10 years with the professional men's team, just under seven of those as assistant coach, and 3 years as head coach with that. The last 2 years I've taken a role as a development officer, but head of basketball. And essentially, right now, I'm in charge of player development, coach development, and sort of setting what we're teaching from a tech point of view as well. So I've been pretty much everything you can do in the organization. But yeah, very much now on trying to influence and impact the grassroots and the academy side of things now.
Ian, just talking about your experiences and the knowledge you must have gained through all of them, that whole journey that you've been on to where you are now, you must have learned so much from different areas of the organization.
Massively. And to be honest, I continue to, because you're not dealing with players and you're not dealing with coaches, you're actually just dealing with people. And because people are so different, I always use this example, but you know, earlier in the year we had a coach CPD session, and a lot of our coaches are very experienced, and the most inexperienced coach we have, 20 years old, he came up with a little concept or something he said, and I've taken that concept and I've said it globally, I've said it to everyone, you know, and I've moved forward with just a very small thing that he suggested. You can always learn. So the players, the people, the coaches I've been exposed to, there's been a lot of learning over the years for sure.
Ian, I think that's a great point, what you've just said there, because yourself within basketball and myself with Northumberland FA around coach development, we put on these events, whether they're online or they're face-to-face, and yeah, it's amazing to hear someone with your knowledge and where you've gone in the game of basketball has taken something from a young coach just starting out on his journey, but that you're going to use within your coaching experiences.
No, for sure. I think you're going to learn from everywhere. I mean, the reason we reconnected is I attended an FA, you know, something you put on from Northumberland FA, because you know, my interest was piqued by the speakers. I've been into the football club and spent days with them, you know, and while the game's different, you're still dealing with people and you're still dealing with sports. So there's a lot of transfer and a lot of crossover, you know.
Yeah, really looking forward to this discussion in the day. So we're gonna chat about the coaching spectrum from a coaching football terminology point of view. But I think yourself, you're gonna use the words block versus random. Coaching is very transferable. Yeah, through different sports scene. So for everyone listening in today, we thought it would be a really good idea to have your knowledge and expertise from a basketball point of view and from the sidelines. So I suppose my first question to you, Ian, is what do you mean from the basketball point of view of block training versus random?
Well, block training, it's often, people say it's traditional. It's not a traditional method, you know, because I always say good old school beats bad new school. You know, just because it's new doesn't mean it's good. But people often say it's traditional. It's not quite right. But block training is essentially without any external stimulus. It's repetitions, the same thing over and over. And there's not really any learning taking place. It's memory. So, for instance, in basketball, you teach a skill in isolation, or you teach simply a technique. And the player becomes comfortable with that drill or that situation. So naturally, it looks better after 10 minutes than it did at the start. But the question you've got to ask yourself is, have they learned something? Have they acquired this technique, which they can then make a skill? Or have they simply become comfortable with the activity? Yeah. It's like the first time you put a drill in training, it's all over the place. They don't know which line to go to next. They don't know who should be passing where. They don't know what the rotations are. But you do that drill a couple of times and it looks great. But actually, is it pretty patterns? Are they getting the patterns correct? Or are they making great decisions? Is there a problem-solving element? Could they do this or do that? And can they justify, what have I seen? What's made me make up my mind to do this? Or have they just remembered the drill and it's going through? And that's random. That's the other end. You could do this or you could do this. And giving them stimulus, i.e. defenders or situations or time limits and all these things where they have to make a correct decision. If there's no decision-making and no problem-solving in the drill, it's block. If there is that element, it's random because the game is random. We don't play alone. And it's replicating the game. So that's our definition of those terms.
Yeah, and I think from our point of view on the football side, Ian, that's the coaching spectrum, looking at unopposed at one end of that spectrum and then opposed, numbers up, numbers down, small side games at the other end of the spectrum, which is exactly what you've mentioned there around. Yeah, what decisions are we coming up to gain some success at the other end of the spectrum as to unopposed? Ian, as coaches, though, before we actually start our planning, do we need to observe and see what the actual players' needs are on where we sit within that block and random or the coaching spectrum?
I think you have to for everything, and particularly with this block and random as well. I'm not, and first off, just to clarify, I'm not saying never do block.
Yeah.
There are some coaches out there who you never do block. Everything has to be random. But I believe there is a place for that, as long as it's not too heavily weighted. Players need to feel what is correct, just from a technical point of view, before they put it into major practice. But I don't like to stay too long on block. But as far as understanding the players' needs, we've all had it. You know, you're going to a new season with a new team. You think you know all the players. And then after the first training session, you go, Jesus, I'm not sure we can do what we've planned here. Because we're not sure the stage everyone's at, particularly if you're recruiting in a team and they've played for 7 or 8 different clubs and they've all now come to your club. They've got different experiences. They've got different understandings. So I think two things for me, and I learned this one the hard way, is don't assume knowledge. Don't assume that these players all have the same understandings of the absolute basics. You might actually have to regress things and do the foundational stuff that you don't want to assume that they all know it. Yeah. And the second thing, and I'm a huge fan of doing this, is what I call covert testing. So for instance, we might be working on passing, but I'm going to start the session off without telling them we're working on passing. We're simply going to play 3v3 or 4v4. And I'm going to step back and I'm going to scan. I'm not going to intervene. And I'm going to watch what their passing's like. I'm going to watch what's their movement to create space and use space. Are they using, you know, left and right hand for us, left and right foot for yourselves? Are the appropriate passes used at the appropriate time? Because if I jump in and coach that and say, right, we're going to play 3v3. I'll make sure you use your left hand when you're passing left, your right hand when you're passing right. And make sure you're working hard to get open. If they do all those things, I don't know if they already knew that. I've just jogged their memory, or I've instructed them already to do it. And all they're doing is following instructions. I want to see what's natural for them. What will they do unprompted? And that's the only way for me that you can truly understand what their learner journey has been previously and where they are now as far as their skill acquisition or their skill development. So covert testing is something I use a lot. Sometimes we'll do something and 2 weeks later, I'll just put it in a warm-up I'll create a situation, small-sided games or constraints-led. I'll create a situation that this is the solution, but I haven't told them it, and see if they actually tap into that learning of just a couple of weeks back. Or they don't. If they don't, all right, we need to do it again, but maybe do it in a different way for them to understand. If they do, there's evidence of learning there, and you can build on that.
Yeah, that's a great point, Ian, that observation skill and art from a coach of observing will ultimately determine where that that particular group starts on their journey with you, whether they're at the block end of the spectrum or they're at the random end. In when we look at unopposed practices, the focus is more around developing that technique. And unopposed with interference is making the players are more looking at their decision making and coming up with solutions to try and outwit their opponents.
And I think with at the block stage, I always ask the young coaches, what's the difference between technique and skill? And technique is, you know, for us, this is your hand placement on the ball. You know, this is your footwork when you make a pass. This is how you dribble with your chin up, making sure you're scanning around. That's the technique. But the skill is application of that technique at the relevant point. So what's important, if you are going to do block phase, or, you know, you start with that, is you can't do one thing and then play a game where it needs to be used. They have to know two or three or four different techniques and then play a game. And true skill is selecting the appropriate technique for the situation, or the making the appropriate decision for the situation. Like, for instance, in a real world example, there's no point practicing left-handed passing for an hour and then playing a 15-minute game and you're going to pass the ball with your left hand, because you might need to pass it with your right hand at some point. There's no point practicing, you know, a little passing drill and then say, we're going to play a game. You have to make five passes before you score. What if there's a fantastic opportunity to score on the third pass and you don't do it because the constraints have actually removed decision-making for you? I'm not going to shoot. Well, you might be, you know, for you guys, you might have a wide open, you might be 6 yards out, but you've got to make extra passes before you're allowed to score. That's not something you're going to take into a game. So you've got to, the block phase, or at least the beginning phase of this, they have to understand what options are out there. They have to explore what options are out there, and then it's the appropriate use of those things. So as you kind of move away from block and into that random, they need to find the solutions, but it's the appropriate ones. That's the key.
And in that random end of the spectrum, that's the realism of what the players are playing on a weekend.
Yeah, for sure. And it's small sided games, you know, it's 3v3, but we'll do it in a small space, or it's different phases of the game. So we might be playing 5v5, it might be a full game, but actually you've got 24 seconds to shoot the ball in basketball. Every time you get possession, you get a shot clock of 24 seconds. But we might be working on our fast break. I think you guys call it transitions. So we might say, actually, it's only a 12-second shot clock. So you're forcing them to still work on the same phase of the game. So you're putting a constraint in, which should prompt the areas and the phases of the game that you've been working on in those situations. So you very much get towards random, which brings its pitfalls as well, because as you know, Gary, you might go into a game and say, this is what we're going to do, and after 5 minutes the other team's done something totally different and you have to change entirely. So one of the biggest pitfalls of using small-sided games and a constraint-led approach and randomness is you might want to play 4v4 working on passing, but that dribbling's really good and they never need to pass. And the problem is they're not defending very well. Then suddenly you get stuck teaching defending, you know, how do you contain a man and not let him get past you? And suddenly you've gone on to the next topic because their shooting's not good and they can't finish. And you haven't realized that you've got away from the original topic because you've started dealing with the random things that are thrown up in games. So coaches' roles, use of assistants and things like that, when you're in random practice, very important to be extremely clear with what you're going to focus on and not get drawn away by the randomness of the game.
Yeah, because and whether it's basketball or football, we're looking to develop skillful players. Skillful players are going to come up with solutions within them practices where it's opposed within them small side games. And it's important that the players gain success as well, Ian.
I think it's important that the players understand what success is as well.
Yeah.
because the ball going in the goal or going through the basket, through the hoop, doesn't mean success. It could be, there could be an accidental hero. The ball's hit them on the back of the head and it's bounced through and someone scored. Does that mean it was good? You know, what actually is the success criteria? And I think that's something else that players have to understand and has to be communicated to them. So quite often we'll be in training and I'll say, right, success here is, let's say we're talking about defending, stopping people catching the ball in a dangerous area, high percentage scores. Success is forcing a high catch, we call it. So they've been forced to catch the ball 6 feet outside the three-point line. That's not a position where they can score from. That's success. Mm-hmm. There's little successes along the way other than just gaining possession back or stopping them scoring. If football example, if you make someone pass it backwards, it's success. There's a little success there. You know, they've not been able to have progressive possession and build their way up the pitch, you know. Lots of little successes along the way. And if you can put KPIs in there and track these things as well to underpin it and support it. I'm working with a group of under-18s now. They're actually under-17s, but they're playing under-18s. And they're going to struggle because, you know, they're a year young. But we're tracking things like in how we call it 5 second races. How many times can we get three players all the way down the court in position within 5 seconds of gaining possession? We're doing things, we call them kills. If we get three stops in a row, stop the other team scoring three times in a row, it's classed as a kill. And we're looking to try and get two or three kills every quarter. So there's little KPIs all along the way of what success is, as opposed to just looking at the scoreboard. Mm-hmm. You won or you lost. So I think actually defining success for players is vital, mm-hmm. especially at a formative age.
Ian, how do you measure it? How are you measuring them solutions with the players? Is it something that you touch coming back to in training through the week?
Yeah, for sure. So we'll have style of playing, you know, the documents that I've created. So all of our training and games will be underpinned. Like, it's not something random that we're chucking in. So any KPI that we measure will underpin our style of play document. So I work from a system I've created called Our Way. It has things like it has statements of intent. So for instance, as a defensive team, it'll say things like, we are notorious for getting deflections and being disruptive. Therefore, any KPI I put in or any constraint I put in has to lend itself towards that. And so it has to justify the statement. On game day, lucky enough to have an assistant with us, not all coaches do, or it could be an injured player, and they're actually tracking live in the game, just a tally. You know, if we've got a timeout or it's end of quarter, I'll turn to the assistant and I'll just say, how many kills did we have in that quarter? How many 5 second races did we win? And what that's doing is it's informing how you're going to communicate with the team as well. So it's all generated from a style of play, tracked live. And again, we're talking about low resource tracking live. There's no drones flying overhead and statistical analysis getting spit out and stuff like that. We're talking about junior basketball. But we do the same in training. So, for instance, if kills is what we're talking about, which is three defensive stops in a row for one kill, we'll play a game where it's the first to two kills. So if you score a basket, it doesn't count for anything on the scoreboard. You just prevent the other team from getting the kill. You're trying to get three stops in a row. And it's simulating the game. It is simulating the randomness mm-hmm. of the game. Mm-hmm. Now, what underpins that? Okay, you underpin that with how do you use your hands? How do you pressure? What's your footwork like? How do you be disruptive as an individual and as a team? That's kind of how we track sort of how we're doing it and how we're performing within the game and the small successes.
Mm-hmm. Great, Ian. Ian, if we're going to challenge the players at that random end of the spectrum, this is ultimately going to develop their skills, their tactics, their expertise within them game situations. But ultimately, the need to demonstrate this, the need to have them techniques to be able to do it. And to have them techniques, we need to work at that block end.
I think
we
do.
The underpost end.
Yeah, for sure. And I think I don't like spending too much time there. And it's a mistake. It's a mistake you can make. And I think the big question is, as coaches, why do we spend so much time at the block end. I think the vast majority of coaches that I come across do spend too much time with block practice. And I think there's a couple of things. It's more comfortable as a coach.
Yeah.
If you're running a drill, if you're running an activity, a game, whatever it is, and it looks good from the outside, there's not, you know, the balls aren't flying off the pitch and it's controlled and, you know, the logistics are really good. It looks good. And if someone's watching that, they might be thinking, well, he's good coaching. Actually, he hasn't said anything, but his drill looks really good. If the balls are flying everywhere and they're making mistakes and they're not sure and maybe some feelings get hurt, or you should have passed to me and you did this wrong, that looks scrappy. And it's uncomfortable, but it's chaos and it's random and it's what the game is.
Yeah.
It's what the game is. There's not many, how many teams in the Premier League play pretty lovely, fantastic football for 90 minutes? You know, so the randomness and that chaos, you know, you have to accept being uncomfortable and you have to accept that the person watching from the outside, the uninformed person, is not going to look at you and say that's a bad practice because it doesn't look tidy. And if they do say that, just because they're uninformed. So I think that's the two reasons why we spend too much time at block. But again, I'm not saying it has no place.
I think even from a player's point of view and going back years when I played, I think there becomes a stage in that block where it becomes boring and you disengage as well. So yeah. I think as a coach, it's known, right, the players have mastered this. Now what's the next challenge for them? And whether that's some slight interference or it's someone opposed, we've got to be clever in our observation to recognise that. Would you see that in basketball? Because I see that in grassroots when I'm out observing coaches. And there's got to be a sort of a good understanding and knowledge of when them players have mastered that, that we then push on to the next thing.
Yeah, for sure. I use a graphic at the start of each season when doing an introduction for all our academy. And I use just a bell curve. And it's motivation versus challenge on this sort of, you know, on the two axes. And if that under-challenged, they'll be under-motivated. You know, God, I've done this before. I've done it 1,000 times. Yeah. So they're under-motivated. Then you start pushing them and they'll get a little bit of success and their motivation goes up. But if you push them too far, and it's too hard and they can't do it, that motivation drops down again, you know. My five-year-old son at home, if he gets a new game that he can't do, that's it. I don't want to play the game anymore, you know.
Yeah.
So, but at the same time, if I give him a five-month-old toy, he's not going to want to play with it. So it's about keeping the players in that sweet spot in the middle. You're pushing them forward, but you're supporting them so they don't get too much overstimulated. You're pulling them back a little bit where needed. So I think keeping them in that sweet spot to keep them motivated and keep them challenged is very important. And just what we mentioned at the start, actually, about learning from other coaches. A guy interviewed for a position at our place who had he had experience as an S&C coach, but he's basketball coach, he's by trade. But he didn't just list on his session plan the progressions of the drill. He listed the regressions as well. What happens if they don't get it? How do I step back in my session plan? Mm-hmm. And I thought that was very interesting because you would see that from a strength and conditioning coach. You know, you try and back squat 150 kilograms. If you didn't do it, you got to take some weight off the bar. But how do I actually take the weight off the bar from a technical point of view? I thought it was really interesting. And that was, again, learning from a young coach, you know.
Yeah, it is really interesting, that, Ian. Ian, so I think you mentioned it at the start of our conversation. I think we need to be working across the whole spectrum through block into random to develop players' technique, but also to develop skillful players to come up and come up with ideas of challenges and beating and gaining success and whatever that success looks like. What would be your key themes around this topic for coaches listening in before we wrap things up?
The key things, I think for me, which I think you alluded to at the start, Gary, is it's the why. Why are we doing these things? The player has to be at the center. So whatever we're doing has to be informed by the player's needs. That's need-centered approach. It's pivotal. So they will inform the direction of things going. But you can't guess what the player's needs are. So the first step is you've got to have open lines of communication. Now, we do things, our coaches, where we actually plan for interactions where we'll say, we're going to speak to this kid today before training on the walk over there or whatever it is, just to open the lines of communication, see what their thoughts are, see how they're thinking, just probing a little bit. But listening to your players, you know, not just saying you need this now and I'm going to put a drill on for it. What do they actually think about it? And I think that's a key part as well. It has to be a need-centered approach. I think if you are going to look at the block end of the practice or you are working at the block end, don't stay there too long. Move them on before they get comfortable and the drill just looks nice. Move them on and challenge them. And the last thing, if you're working at the other end of the spectrum, if you're lucky enough to have assistant coaches, be extremely clear with who's responsible for what. If me and you are taking a training session, I'll say, right, Gary, I'm going to look at the defense. You look at the offense. Make sure they're moving the ball. That's all you've got to do. I'm going to hammer down on the defense. Because the last thing we want to do is you notice someone with a bad shot technique, so you go over there and intervene and teach them about it. But actually, I've done the same thing 5 minutes ago. There's mixed messages, and suddenly we've lost the whole point of the session. So at the random end, very clear with what you're looking for, very clear with what success is, and stay on point with your training sessions. Because the game is random, so can your focus be as well. If you're not super clear with where you want to go, then don't get caught coaching every aspect of the game.
Brilliant, Ian. Ian, I've thoroughly enjoyed catching up with you today and chatting around block versus random, a coaching spectrum. And good luck with the Eagles and your role there.
Thank you very much, Gary. It's been a pleasure, mate.
Cheers, Ian. Thank you.
Thank you.